Welcome, everybody, to Then and Now. I'm Brad Sham, and we are on the cusp of another football season, another professional football season. And you cannot talk about the construction of a new Dallas Cowboys team without talking about Will McClay, whose business card reads Vice President and Assistant Director of Player Personnel. Right? Did I get that right?
I think it does.
Okay.
I
it seen... changes all the time. There's
yeah,
a lot of words in
it
there.
It does.
Yeah. But that's what it said in the media guide last year. Nowhere will you find it written, but everywhere in the NFL will you heard it understood that Will McClay is also the Jones Whisperer. He has figured out a way to talk to and be heard by, and thank you for laughing at that. And it's a circuitous route that took you from Memphis to Houston for two high schools and Rice University.
Yes.
And then we're going to do the travelogue later. Am I doing okay so far?
Yeah, you're doing good.
All right.
We'll see if I can remember.
All right. Well, you're younger than me, so you ought to be able to. But let's go back, since this is then and now. There's no question that since you have had, I don't want to say you're in charge of the draft, because you're
I'm a
not
part of the draft.
Named Jones.
Yes.
But you have had a... We won't quibble on your having increased input over the last 5 years, will we?
Absolutely.
Okay.
I've had that opportunity.
How did you become a Jones Whisperer?
I think through the course of this whole draft player acquisition process is there's a number of voices that go into a room. And Jerry's notorious for finding information from everywhere and then being able to process that information. So what... really, we tried to do in the beginning was I want to be able to know the player, speak about the player in a way that Jerry understands it from what he can do for the team, you know, what it does to us economically, try and marry, because we're a different process. If the ownership makes the decision, but they have other things going on, let's find a way to get all of the information, get on the same page with the coaches, and come together. And if we're going to fight, let's fight in that room and let him make the decision that way, as opposed to anything, you know, outside of it, or, you know, trying to get the attention of. And so really want to try and get everybody's opinion and find a way to put that all in a process where we can get it out, get all the information out, try and account for everybody's biases and unbiases and all that other stuff, and let's make the right decision.
Interesting to me that I said Jones Whisperer, and you went right to Jerry, because he is at the top of the food chain in the Cowboys organization, but he's not the only strong-willed guy named Jones with an opinion.
No.
Or person, not just guy, in the room. And you've had to learn to whisper in each of their languages, have you not?
Yeah, and I think the whispering is give them the facts and truth as I know them, and try and take all the information from all the work that everybody's done, the coach's opinion, and say, okay, here's A, B, and C. This is the information. Now they'll say, what is your thought? And I'm very strong at giving my opinions about it, and it's very fortunate to work with Steven, because Steven knows Jerry, and Steven takes the bites a lot more than I do, and he's well-conditioned and calloused for that. But Steven and I's relationship, he trusts me, he drives me, he makes me make sure that I'm right, because he doesn't want to get bit. So that relationship helped foster the relationship with Jerry, and him understanding what my role is, what my objective is, and what I'm trying to do, and how we can help the football team get better. But it all started with Charlotte and Shy. I mean, Shy called me. I was in Jacksonville and wanted me to coach arena football.
Okay, you took that half step before I was going there, because we're going to have to jump around a little bit, because this is all part of the deal. Your NFL job, one, prior to coming here, was in Jacksonville in the scouting department,
yes,
right? Okay. But as you say, before that, you had a lot of experience in the Arena Football League, which is how you came to, I presume, be acquainted with Shy Anderson, Charlotte Jones Anderson's husband.
Yes, that's what happened.
So let's go back to a little further back then. So when you were a freshman at Rice University, and a team captain as a freshman and a starter as a freshman.
I was a starter. I wasn't a captain until my senior year.
Senior year, okay. But you were a four-year starter.
Yes.
And a senior captain. But let's go back to being a freshman, starter, defensive back at Rice University. If I had told you that we're going to send you on about a 12-year travelogue through two other leagues before we get you to a position that some people will see as commensurate with being an NFL general manager, and here's how you're going to do it, what would your reaction have been?
I said, no way. I mean, because I went into, you know, education was number one. I'm, you know, my mom and dad and brother, grew, you know, Houston was our place, all right? Education was the deal. When I got recruited by Rice, Mike Nolan recruited me, who's coached in the NFL. My mom fell in love with Mike Nolan because, you know.
He was coaching at Rice.
He was coaching at Rice. And you know, we didn't win very many games, but I think that kind of started. I wanted to go get into the NFL. Thought I was going to be a great player.
Okay, so that's one thing I wanted. When you go to Rice, one of the great, seriously, institutions of higher learning in the country, not a football factory.
Right.
But you go to Rice with the idea of someday you want to play in the NFL.
Oh, there's no question. And I went to Rice because I could play as a freshman. That's what I thought. Mike Nolan had recruited me. Watson Brown was coaching. Rice had won five games the year before I got there.
Which, P.S., means you had to be able to get into Rice.
Yes.
And
yeah.
do the work.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. And I didn't know how much.
I don't want to disparage any other institution of higher learning, but that everybody can't get in. I couldn't have got into Rice.
No, it was a little, and it was different. It was difficult when going through the process, and Coach Nolan would say, well, we want you here, and da-da-da-da, and you know, being a high school kid, I'm thinking about going to Boston College or University of Texas and places that I had gotten recruited by. But Coach Nolan came in and started talking about school and the education of Rice and everything else. And my mom fell in love with him, with how he was as a person. And she believed in him. And then going to Rice, she could keep her eye on me. And then
did you need keeping an eye on
him? Yeah. I was a 18-year-old young man that you know
okay.
thought that my stuff
pretty
didn't
good.
Stink.
Yeah, okay.
You know,
very good.
But always grounded. Going back to mom, so mom and dad. So being recruited there, I played quarterback in high school, and I wanted to be a quarterback. Then when I went to Rice, Watson Brown was the head coach, and we were kind of run and gun. We were throwing it around. I was an option quarterback. So we had one practice, and they quickly said, you go over to DB. And I've been,
One practice.
Yeah, I wanted to run the option. They wanted to throw the ball 50 times.
Okay.
That wasn't going to happen.
Okay. In your first 3 years at Rice, how many times did you play Miami?
We played Miami once.
And did you cover Michael Irvin in that game?
I covered Michael Irvin.
How'd you do?
I thought I did pretty well. I don't get my memory. I'm getting older. I don't remember all that. But I do remember.
Well, trust me on this one. The answer then should be, I shut him out.
I'm not going to lie, because then he'll come back and he'll come on. I heard you good. No. But I do remember my first game in college against University of Miami. First of all, I talked to Alonzo Highsmith, who's now in Cleveland, and he was on that team, and it was the hottest game that we had ever played. It was probably, you know, they had that, you know, it was the old school turf, and it was 150 degrees on the field or whatever. It was so hot. And Miami was, we battled them the first quarter a little bit, and then they had all that talent, started kicking our butt. Well, the first game of my college career, I got kicked out of the game because I was a little feisty little corner. They had an offensive lineman. I cannot remember his name, but he blocked me out of bounds in the middle of them kicking our butt. And I got up and shoved him, and he shoved me, and I threw a punch, and they kicked me out. Wasn't very becoming of a Rice man, as I'd come to find out later. And my mom and dad got a little pissed off at me about that and representing the McClays the right way. But that was my first experience, and that was I think it was the only time we played Miami. We played other people that really kicked our butt, but Miami was the first one.
And how seriously do you remember how many times did you have to cover Michael, and how'd you do?
I didn't remember because I didn't know it was. They had Michael Irvin, they had Shakespeare, they had you know, they had all these players, and at the time,
kind of like, a blur.
It was a blur. Yes.
All right. At what point in there, now you've got a degree in political science.
Yes.
Why aren't you in Congress?
Because it's a lot easier doing what we do.
Because that's a dirty business.
It's a dirty business. I really thought, I told my mom that, okay, I was going to get my degree number one. I said, well, if I don't play football, I'm going to be a lawyer. After the first semester taking classes at Rice, I was like, I don't know about that. It was a little bit more difficult. And after going through 4 years of Rice, it was really, really challenging to play sports and to survive academically there. When they told me that I had achieved everything I needed to graduate, I'm like, I'm not going to school ever again.
You were too smart for that. Okay, so you've got a degree from Rice. At what point in that, maybe I'm going to guess in that senior year, your captaincy, did you realize you weren't going to be playing in the NFL?
That went through all the way, you know, because you have your pro days and people come to see you and all that good stuff. And I remember there's a guy from the Atlanta Falcons, a scout, that said, okay, because I went into college weighing 175 pounds, and I was pretty fast then. Well, then we got, you know, three square meals a day, the weight room. I ended up being 205, 208 pounds, being a bigger corner. So I wanted to play safety because I was smart, but no, I got to be a corner. So to be a corner at the time, you had to be fast. And my time went from about a 4.4 coming in. I ended up being a 4.6 corner. There's not very many 4.6 corners that make it. But the guy in Atlanta told me, if you run under 4.6, you're going to be an Atlanta Falcon. So I had trained, and I remember running the 40. I took I had my shorts on. I think I ran barefoot, everything I could to try and get under 4.6. And then I didn't get drafted. I had an agent, didn't get drafted, disappointed, the whole deal. Didn't go to camp, really. Had a couple of opportunities. But then the Arena Football League, Tim Markham, God rest his soul, who coached at Rice and had been around forever, was coaching the Arena Football League in Detroit. And he called me up and said, do you want to play Arena Football?
The Detroit Drive.
Detroit Drive, yes. It was owned by Mike Ilitch. And
Mike Ilitch was the pizza baron who owned the Red Wings.
Red Wings,
and
the Tigers.
The Tigers.
Yes.
He owned everything in Detroit.
Yes.
Okay.
And in 1989, they had a camp, and I went to the camp and showed out, and I could play. I was a good athlete, good enough athlete to play receiver and DB. And the premise behind the Arena Football League is that you had to play both ways. I could do that. And so I got the opportunity. They were paying us. We were making $200 a week, and we had $100 win bonus. But the league was trying to come back from where it had been. And so there were four teams that first year. We all had training camp in Rensselaer, Indiana, and all the teams played against each other, and we practiced and we competed. And so I made the team. And there were guys that John Corker, who was the USFL Defensive Player of the Year, Tate Randall, who had played. There's a bunch of these older players that played, and I was like, wow.
Who had played in the NFL.
Had played in the NFL, and I was like, wow, well, this is as close as I'm going to get right now, and I'm going to use it as a stepping stone. And we played, and we won a championship, and I fell in love with football again. I wasn't in love with football after being the captain of Rice, and you're the captain, and you're supposed to lead the team. In my senior year, we were 0-11.
Ooh.
Yeah. And that was hard. I remember going into Coach Burnt used to have this deal, and Jerry Burnt was the head coach at that time, and he would come in, and he'd have this leadership meeting. And I remember sitting in the room, and we were 0-9 at the time. It was myself, Courtney Hall, who went on to play in the NFL, Quintus Roper, and Donald Hollis. And we're the captains.
Hollis played in the league, too.
Yes,
didn't he?
Hollis did, too. Yeah. And we're sitting in the in his office, and he goes, we're 0-8. And, you know, the competitor in you wants to win. And he's asking these questions. And I remember, and Courtney Hall can tell you the story, I remember saying, because I was outspoken and always have had an issue with stating my opinion. And I said, Coach, this is not going to work. And he says, well, what do you mean? I go, Coach, we're 0-8, and we're trying to run the ball in the Southwest Conference with linemen that weigh 250 pounds, and I kind of let it all be known at that point in time.
Didn't have a lot to lose at that point.
Didn't have a lot to lose, except for three more games. Football wasn't fun. I grew up playing football. My father introduced me to football when I was 6 years old and got an opportunity to – there's a lot of in Houston. I grew up in Houston, so in Houston it was called the Fun Football League. If you remember where when the Houston Gamblers and the USFL came out, they used to play at our stadium.
Okay.
So, and there were a lot of old NFL greats that coached me when I was a kid in a bunch of different areas. So I loved it and grew up in the game, and it's all we knew. And that love, after getting your butt kicked and going to school there, it kind of dissipated a little bit. Yeah, I didn't make the league. I was disenfranchised with football a little bit, the thing that I said that I was going to do and be great at. But I remember telling my dad, at some point in time, I'm going to make it in the NFL. And now, come to this point, I'm here. But with arena football, it was a traveling road show. We played games in different cities. We used to call it Bingo Long and the Traveling All-Stars.
Had no question. And you only got four teams, you said.
Yes, yes.
And how many games were you playing?
I think we played that year we played –
now, this has got to be like
89. We played 10 or 12 games, and then we played two games in the playoffs. So what happened was you'd be in a city, and we would go to each, you know, the teams would travel, but we would jump in cars and drive, or we'd have a team van. And so we'd play in Cincinnati. We'd drive to Cincinnati. And the teams were regional, and you'd drive, and you'd stay in a hotel. And it's like minor league baseball.
So if you got $200 a game and a $100 win bonus, and I'm real bad at math, which is one of the many reasons I could never have gotten into Rice, but my rough calculation would put you somewhere short of $5,000.
Oh, yeah.
For that season.
Yes,
you can't live in Detroit in 1989 on $5,000.
No, well, they had housing for us during the season. Well, I was smart enough to handle my business. They thought I was fairly smart.
I mean, you went to Rice.
Yeah. And so in the off season, they found jobs for us because that's, you know, they wanted to keep the team around. And so I worked at Mr. Illich's Fox Theater. I was a security guard at night.
Fox Theater in Detroit.
I was a security guard at night and waited for the next season to come around and did that. And in the meantime, mom and dad were like, you got to get a job. You went to Rice, da 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 da, all my friends. You know, all that stuff. Well, I was happy with, you know.
But you were back in love with football.
I was back in love with football again. I truly was. I was like, I couldn't wait for the next season. And then being around those guys that have been places and, you know, Perry. There's a lot of old NFL guys that had coached in that league, too. Babe Parilli.
Oh, man.
Perry Moss. You know, all of those guys. And so I'm starting to meet these former players and these former coaches, and I'm going, boy, this, you know, it's football. It's fun. We in Joe Louis Arena, they gave away tickets. We didn't sell very many, but it was a packed house every game we played. I loved the city of Detroit. Then I played for two more years, and I didn't make any money, obviously. So
I made a lot of contacts.
Made a lot of contacts and really, really, really fell in love with the game again. And so then I wanted to take a job. I worked for an adoption agency because I wanted to save the world. My dad used to say, a broke man can't save the world. So I went to work with this adoption agency, and I was using my Rice degree, I was the marketing director for an adoption agency. And abandoned, abused, and neglected kids. The name of the place was Orchards Children's Services. And so we had this idea using Illich and sports. We were going to try and come up with this outreach program where we brought baseball back to the inner city of Detroit, and we cleaned up Belle Isle, and we worked with the Tigers, and the goal was to put the kids that are in the community that have their issues, but they're the same as the other kids, and so we want to put all the kids out on baseball teams with the other kids and try and increase the adoption rate within the area. And did that for a couple of years, and I wanted to bring all the
moderately
kids home.
Successful.
Moderately successful. I mean, it changed some things, and
if you do one kid, you've saved a life.
Yes,
that's a huge success. I don't mean to minimize it.
No, there's no question, but there's only. So you, again, I would be frustrated. I wanted to bring the kids home. I grew up in a home where, like, my dad was adopted, and he used to bring in kids in the neighborhood if they weren't. You know, if they were doing something wrong and their parents kicked them out, my dad would bring them in and they'd live with us for a couple of days or whatever, and he'd try and straighten them out. So that was kind of a deal for me to try and save the world, you know, at that point in time, but didn't make enough money. And then it started getting hard. It started getting hard, too, because there were some kids that didn't find homes. There were some kids that remained in the system, and I couldn't comprehend that, and you couldn't fight the politics of it and all
that
good
stuff. It's a tough city when things aren't
going well. It was a tough time in that city when I was there. Learned a lot about life living in Detroit, for sure.
So my list takes you from the Detroit Drive to the Milwaukee Mustangs to the Florida Bobcats. Did you start coaching in Milwaukee?
I started coaching in Detroit.
In Detroit.
After I retired in 92, I retired from a four-year stellar arena football career. Okay. I started coaching.
Because you're still in love with football.
I love football. I love football and the independence of being away from Texas. And, you know, because I grew up here, you're around here. So I'm in Detroit, Michigan, and it's snow and, you know, it's life and, you know, single young man.
Yes.
You know, I was an entrepreneur, too. I had a business in Detroit where I would, because I worked with, part of my drive in Red Wing history, too, was, again, Illich and Gary Vito, who was Mr. Illich's right-hand man, who ran our arena team, got me with the Red Wings. So I was kind of the Red Wings' strength and conditioning coach. I would help with strength and conditioning because it was football, blah, blah, blah.
How many African-Americans were working in the NHL in 19?
There weren't very many. There weren't very many. And I got to be good friends with a lot of hockey guys.
Yeah.
I got to learn that hockey guys,
they know how to have a good time.
They're a whole different breed. I was around the organization when Bob Probert and Sheldon Kennedy and when Chris Osgood came in and Darren McCarty and all of these guys, and they would drink and smoke cigarettes and they would ride a bike for 2 hours and go out and skate and punch each other and da-da-da-da-da, and then they'd go out and drink hard all night, and then the next day they're at it again. And so that was a unique experience for me in seeing athletes in a different light than football players. So, but I went through all of that, and then I coached the arena team, and then I said, the Detroit team folded.
They folded. How did the coaching job in Detroit come about?
Because Markham said, I told him I didn't want to play anymore. I wasn't making any money. I was going to do this, and in the meantime, I was also doing the adoption agency stuff. And when the season rolled around, I jumped in and did both.
Yeah.
Then I said, well, you know what? I think I can be a pretty good coach. And arena football was – and then I went back to Rice to GA in – I believe it was 90 or 91 under Coach Goldsmith. So – doing that, I kind of started in the coaching path. And I said,
that's about the time you start paying attention to the details of coaching.
Yes.
And once you're in coaching, you're paying attention to personnel.
Yes,
right?
You're paying attention to personnel.
Okay.
And that's when I went to Milwaukee, I was the defensive coordinator, and I asked for the title of director of player personnel just to try and figure out.
Now, you know, the drive in the early 90s, the Milwaukee, the Florida Bobcats, what are you making, $25,000?
Yeah, I think the most I made coaching for a while was probably $22,000 to $28,000.
Then you're the pro personnel director and defensive coordinator of the Anaheim Piranhas.
Yes.
And then we go on to the Grand Rapids Rampage, which for people who know a little bit about the history of the Arena Football League, actually was a kind of a signal franchise in the Arena League.
Yes.
I mean, great. That must have been fun in Grand Rapids.
Oh, it was great because there was nothing else in Grand Rapids really other than the hockey team, and we were the new thing in town. And so it was really like NFL football. When you go in, it was Van Andel Arena. There's 15,000 to 18,000. We're the new game in town. It was a big deal.
This is the Jones Whisperer, friends. We're going to get him to the NFL here in a minute. But first, we're going to the XFL.
Yes.
And the Orlando Rage. Okay. Now, there are all kinds of stories about the XFL. I'm presuming they were all true.
And they're all true,
yeah.
Pretty much. Yes.
Okay. So, how did that happen?
I was working in Grand Rapids, and there's a guy, Mike Keller, who Had been around forever. He actually played for the Cowboys with the Cowboys. He was in the scouting department or something, and he was notorious for finding the new leagues. And I had been doing the personnel, and I had started getting into trying to.
We're in the middle 90s?
We're in the middle 90s.
Okay, good.
And to find players for the Arena Football League, you had to contact the NFL personnel guys. So I started that and started seeing what guys were doing and understanding what players in the AFL made it. So, and we'd built pretty good teams in the AFL. So Keller was jumping into the XFL and he was telling me about it and, you know, oh, it's going to be great and we're going to challenge the NFL and the whole deal and it's Vince McMahon and it's WWE and da 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 or whatever it was at that point in time. Yeah. And
you hate me.
Yeah. And so I said, okay, I'm going to do it. And I got a job that was making more than $20,000 a year, and the opportunity to do that. And so I remember going to Connecticut, being hired as a, consultant. And my job was to learn the league, how we were going to put the league together from guys like Dick Mansberger, who used to work
He was like the head of the scouting department here, right under Gil Brandt.
Yes.
For the formative years of the franchise.
Yes. And he taught me how to write reports and players and, you know, at an NFL level. And that's what we were trying to build with the XFL. The football part was very genuine. And the coaches that we hired and the personnel people and trying. Now, it was the outside show that was driving it.
What was Will McClay's game plan then?
Your
end game was not to make the Orlando Rage as good as you could make them. That was the task in front of you.
It was at that point because,
not thinking about, I'm going to get into the NFL, coaching front office, this is how I'm going to get there?
No, I started thinking about front office a little bit more at that point in time when we put together a good team and it was all – the organization of it was all on me. And so I realized, hey, I can kind of do this. And then learning how to do it, other than the Arena Football League, finding a good player and then trying to figure out if you could get him to play for as little money as you wanted to pay him.
The essence of being a general manager.
Yes.
Is all this why you've been able to – I'm hopscotching a little for a minute – is all that why you have been as successful as you've been in the last few years, finding players once training camp starts? I mean, you know how to find players?
There's no question. It's because we had to dig for players. We had to find them. We had to convince them to play. We had to, it was rogue scouting, to say the least. I mean, because the NFL Europe was going on then. Our season was going. So you're trying to find players. I'm trying to keep a job. And the only way I learned that players make coaches better. And so whatever it took to find players, and I listened to players a lot. And to this day, players know players. They're in the locker room with them. They understand the culture of the guys that are in the locker room now. And they can tell you the real players want to win, and they'll tell you if a guy can play or not. That helps me. And then talking to people around the league and the NFL and starting to figure out what systems do players fit in. In the Arena Football League, I spent a lot of time talking to Tom Heckert, Lionel Vitale, who's here now. I remember calling him and asking him about Arena Football players that they had for the Arena Football League. So now we go to the XFL. I have those resources, telling them what we're doing. You know, if a guy's not good enough, send him to us. We started watching more tape and started really understanding what it meant to put a team together, working with Galen Hall and working with coaches and what are they looking for. And
that was right around 2000-ish.
Yes.
How'd you get to Jacksonville?
The XFL folded. It was funny. Galen Hall and I would go to the league meeting. We went to the league meeting in Connecticut, and we were talking about the second years after the first year. And, you know,
Galen, let me interrupt you a second. Galen Hall, for those of you who don't know, at this point he's in the XFL. He had a tremendous career as a head coach at University of Florida, among other things.
Yes.
So this is this is a guy with a lot of skins on the wall.
A lot of football. I mean, there's a lot of skins on the wall, and there's a lot of great football minds and people within that league. And I found out that I'm just as smart as they are. You know what I mean?
Yep.
And so I gained that confidence to do that. And then the league folded. Galen and I went up to a league meeting where we were, you know, we're preparing for year two, and we both walked out of that meeting in the Connecticut airport, and we're like, you know, it'd be crazy if they folded this deal. And we're sitting there, and across the ticker goes, the WWE has folded the XFL. The doors were closed. I'm going, you know, no paychecks or anything. I'm going, how am I going to get from Orlando, Florida, to something?
Had your son been born yet?
No, he hadn't been born
yet.
So
you didn't have any kids yet?
No kids yet. Okay. I was still trying to figure it out.
Okay.
I had, through the connections I had met through the XFL and the Arena Football League and all that stuff, I started calling people, and I had
You're out of work.
I'm out of work, yeah. And I'm gonna go work in the front office. I'm not gonna do the arena thing again because I know that I can do this a little bit. So I interviewed in Kansas City for a college job, and started to find out about college scouting, how you're on the road, you're a traveling salesman, you go and you do that. So I wanted to do whatever. And then I interviewed at Jacksonville, and when I went to Jacksonville, Coach Coughlin was the head coach, and I came in to interview, and he sat me down, and I had to write reports on six guys. I wrote reports.
You're going to put tape up, and you,
yeah,
off that tape, you're going to write a report.
I'm going to write a report. What do you think about these guys? And they wanted to see how you put thoughts together, how you evaluated the player, what his weaknesses were. And there was a player that they were talking about signing in free agency, and it was a cornerback, and I can't remember his name, but he was a guy that I crushed on my evaluation. I didn't like him. And so I did the interview. I left. They called me back, and I met with Coach Coughlin. And all of us that know Coach Coughlin, he's right in your face, and you can be intimidating. He goes, well, why did you grade this guy like this? This guy can play. We think this guy can play. And I said, well, I'm just telling you what I saw on tape, and you asked for my opinion. That's what it is. I don't think he can play. These are the issues. Da, da, da. And he goes, okay, well, thanks. And I left, and I went home, and Kansas City had called and offered me an area job. And I was contemplating taking it. I didn't want to be on the road all the time, but I was contemplating taking it.
And by the way, for those of you who don't understand, an area job means you're going to have, I'm going to make one up, the Southeast Conference.
Yes.
Or the Southeastern United States.
United States.
Won't all be SEC schools.
No.
It'll be some small schools. It'll be some HBUC schools. It'll be,
yes,
whatever's in the Southeast.
Yes.
Or it could be the Northwest.
And you're in your car, especially at that time, driving from school to school to school. You know,
lovely life.
Yes. Okay. I had been given the whole background. But then I was going to take that job, and probably a couple of hours before I called the guy in Kansas City to take the job, Coach Coughlin called and said, we want to offer you the assistant director of pro personnel in Jacksonville. Well, I was in Orlando. It was a short drive. Hey, it's pro football. It's director's level, coming from where I came from. I'm going to jump on it. And so I went up to Jacksonville that 1 year.
Make enough money to live on?
Yeah, I mean, I was in the NFL now, you know.
Right. I just want to get you up from 200
yes.
a game.
Okay. Yeah. No, it was a living. I remember calling my mom, and I bought a new car.
Waha.
Yeah.
Okay, and then Shai and Charlotte called in 2002.
Yes. They were starting an arena football. And
how'd you know them? How did they know you?
Shai called me. He had been doing research on the Arena League and trying to get the best coaches to help support the great Joe Avezzano, because Joe was going to coach the team. And the reputation I'd had talked to a number of people in the Arena League, and they ended up calling me in Jacksonville. And even though it was an arena football team, it was owned by the Cowboys, so there was that talking to an employee of another NFL club about leaving. And he called me, and it was a grind of an experience in Jacksonville.
Tom Coughlin was not a day at the beach?
It wasn't a day at the beach, no. And I'd been around, you know, some good coaches and whatnot, but I wanted to get back to Texas. My mom had gotten sick. and I wanted to get back home. I had Detroit and all these other cities. I wanted to be back home. And the opportunity, it was when he told me it was owned by the Cowboys and, you know, you'd get to coach. And I said, you know, to be the defensive coordinator. And what I wanted to do was, well, I made it in the NFL now, which is where I told my father I was going to be. And I ended up, I'm here now, and I'm not going to go back to the Arena Football League, and that's it. And so I asked if I could continue to scout because I'm the assistant director here. And Larry Lacewell was running the scouting department. So I talked to Larry, and Larry said, yeah, sure. We'll see what he's got. And then I would coach the arena team, and then I would scout in the off season of the arena team.
You mentioned Joe Avezzano. How did he inform what you became when you were the head coach of the Desperados and then even now?
Joe and I had this wonderfully unique relationship because, as you know, Joe, he is going to let you know when he disapproves of things more than he'll let you know when he approves of things. So in coaching for him and trying to teach him the arena game, he was stubborn.
And that wasn't easy.
No. He was stubborn. And we would have these confrontations, and I would go at him respectfully. And
because it's football, but it's not
it's,
the football.
It's not, no, and he was trying to make it what it was, and I'm trying to explain to him that it's not. And we would have these long discussions, and he would slam his door on me, and I would walk off, and you don't know what the hell he's talking about, you know, all those things. And then at one point in time, I had told him something, and it came to fruition on a play, and then we had an opportunity to win the game. And so then he got closer to me, and he would talk, and we were, you know, he was really influential in the fact of he taught me things about how to stand up for what you believe in, be respectful, because Joe was going to stand up for what he believed in, and to be respectful and to get to a point to get your point across. And he was very instrumental in that and dealing with him because he was the great Joe Avezzano. You know, you'd see him on the Cowboy sideline, and then – you know, he brought me into his family and, you know, hey, this, you know, and that was a really big deal. And then he represented to the Joneses, to Lacewell and those people when it came time to come scout for the Cowboys that I knew what I was talking about.
And then Joe left and you took over as the head coach in 04.
Yes.
And you were coach of the year in the Arena Football League in 2006.
Yes.
And was there ever a time that you thought, you know, maybe I should be really concentrating my efforts on coaching in the NFL?
Oh, yeah, it was. I mean, there was a point in time when I remember when Campo was coaching with Brett Maxey was here. They were the secondary coaches, and the arena season had ended, and the NFL, we were in off season now. And so Campo couldn't coach, and so I got to run the DBs with Maxey. And I'm like, boy, I kind of know – I loved coaching. I love coaching because you're in the game, and I love the aspect of maybe helping somebody get – maybe helping the best of the best get better at what they're doing. And I loved it. I loved being out there. But I had started that path in the front office. And because I had spent so much time in the Arena Football League, the 11-man game had changed so much. Like, they're drawing stuff on the board. I get the concepts, but why don't this guy have to? So I felt like I was behind the eight ball on the coaching side and what I had to learn to catch up, and felt better and more comfortable in the front office side and scouting personnel and helped. That's when I started to say, you know, I want to figure out how to do this and put a team together and a team that wins a championship.
And so that, for the last 5 years, has been the bulk of your role.
Mm-hmm.
You've been very involved in that. And people who know this organization will say, yeah, he's done a great job in finding players and player evaluation and talking to Jerry. But the thing that Will McClay has done that's most important and best, and you mentioned this earlier, is getting the coaches and the scouts on the same page, because it's amazing how often that's not the case. What's the secret to doing that?
It's respecting the people you work with and being stubborn and helping people realize that we don't make the decisions. So if you don't make the decisions And if we're
we
not...
We being who?
The head coach, the person, you know, if I'm the personnel director, whatever, we don't make the decisions. Jerry makes the decisions. And if we're not aligned and if we're not working together, one of the big things is, boy, he's, you know, he goes everywhere and listens to everything to help get that information. Well, part of it is because we can't get on the same page. And whether we like this, and coaches are trying to win now. Personnel side's trying to build for the future. Well, there can be a marriage of the two, but there's also got to be a mutual respect. I used to, because I was a coach working in the scouting side, I would hate when scouts would say, coaches don't know what they're doing. They're screwing this whole deal up. They're not using them the right way. And then being on the coaching side, I would hate when coaches would say the personnel side, they didn't get us the guys that we want, blah, 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 blah. Well, at the end of the day, it's two different disciplines, but it's around the same game. So on the scouting side, can we learn football and the vocabulary of the coaches and what they're trying to do well enough to whereas I can have a conversation with them and they respect it because I'm speaking their language. I'm talking about a player the way that they can understand, and then they would communicate with us the right way so that now we can say we're closer to getting the same page. I still might like a player for this and you like him for that, but we can have those discussions and arguments in front of the people that make decisions and somehow, some way, come to a conclusion as to what's best for us. It's so mutual respect.
So you have to do that in deciding who to draft. You have to do that in deciding how to advise the ownership to spend its money
yes.
on veteran players,
yes,
as well as on player acquisition. And so can you ever tell as an organization in the NFL today with the rules being what they are how far away you are from where you want to be?
No, because each year's so different. You know, the way injuries occur now, all the things that happen, you want to build a team that gives you an opportunity each year to be in the fight because it's so much luck and skill and all that other stuff involved in things that you can't control. But if you have the right people, you have depth, you have guys that you believe in, guys that'll grow, guys that can do their job at an NFL level. Now the coaches coach them and put them together. And then how does that whole thing gel? It's a hard thing to do.
But you must love the challenge of doing it.
Oh, there's nothing better. Now, to put together a team and to be proud of that team on the field, how well they play. Number one job is to win games in the NFL. We're trying to build a winner. But to see those guys come in and perform and the things that you see in them being right and telling the coaches how to use them and working together, you get closer and closer. And the closer you get, the harder you work because you want that ultimate goal. And at the end of the day, like people, because of all this, none of this stuff is me at all. It's just trying to put it together. But people say, okay, well, why don't you go be a GM somewhere else and do that and call your own shots? That's not important to me. What's really important to me is winning a championship here for the Dallas area, for the Dallas Cowboys, for Jerry, for everything they've done for me. It's like, let's win. Let's find a way to do that.
And you don't mean to suggest that you don't want to be a general manager in the NFL.
No, that's not the case at all. When the time is right and when things are right and it's the right situation, because in the NFL nowadays, back in the day when the great ones, the Bill Polians, the Ozzie News, when they were doing it, you got time to set a 5-year plan and see that come to fruition and build and people to trust and believe in and kind of build an organization that way from the ground up. That doesn't happen very often anymore. The structure of it, if the coach has all the power and you're the GM, then what are you? You know, the structure has to be right. You got to, and the foundation to win now has to be there. If I'm going to take this leap of faith that if I don't win in 2 years, I'm going to be fired and be fighting to get back in, I better have all the cards in my favor to give us a chance to do that.
And so you may feel like you've answered this, but since you opened this door, I am the owner of another team.
Mm-hmm.
Can be any team in the world. And I get permission to interview you, and you go on the interview.
Mm-hmm.
and you make your presentation. Now, I'm going to say to you, McClay, I like what you're made of. What's it going to take for me to get you?
Well, you got to have cap room. I've got to have the ability to work with you as the owner to figure out who the coach is. The philosophies have to align. Things have to be in order to give us an opportunity to have success in the time frame that you give. And that's a question that you throw back to them. And I mean, am I going to have the authority to do this? Are we going to have the right people to do this? Do we have the resources to do it? Because really you only get two to three years to show that what you're doing works.
I've got a couple of other unrelated questions. They're brief. How many Astros banners or jerseys or things do you have around your place?
I don't have any. I just know where I'm from.
You're a big fan.
I know that we won the World Series. I grew up an Astro buddy. My dad used to take me and my brother, and there's nothing greater than that. And my dad used to live and die by the Astros and the Rockets and what they did.
You said the Rockets, and I'm told that you are a real Rockets front runner who claims to be a Rockets fan, but probably only watches them like in the finals.
That's true because I'm watching football all the time. But no, I watch my Rockets. I talk to my brother about, and again, it's that connection with my dad. I remember before he passed, like I got an opportunity. Somebody that was here knew somebody at Houston, and I got a chance to take him to a playoff game when they played Golden State 3 years ago in the playoffs. And we got there for the whole deal. So I'm a Rockets fan. I'm a fair weather fan, but I still wear my colors true.
You're an Astros fan.
But I'm an Astros fan. Okay. I mean, I grew up baseball.
On various platforms and devices, how many songs do you have recorded and downloaded?
Oh, geez. I couldn't even tell you because now there's Spotify and now, I mean, I've got music, all different kinds of music from everywhere. Tens of thousands.
Favorite genres?
I love the blues growing up. The old school R&B, listening to it, taking me back to time when I was a kid. And, you know, whenever I get a little outside myself, my mom will say, you need to go listen to some Teddy Pendergrass or something like that to get myself going. Grew up in the hip-hop genre, but I also, my dad came back. I remember my dad came back from Vietnam, and when I was a little kid, I got it from my dad. So he would sit and listen to all kind of music. And we lived in a predominantly black neighborhood, but his friend Hal was a white guy that used to come over to the house, and they would drink whatever that brown liquor was, and they would sit and talk, and they would listen to music. And it was Led Zeppelin, Jimi Hendrix, all the old school
rock.
Any
cigars involved in?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Gosh. It was, I mean, I remember my mom saying, y'all take that out of the house, and we lived in an apartment. But when they would get done having their time together, my dad would tell me to come sit down, and he would be listening to music. He'd had a little bit of the brown liquor, and we'd sit down, and he'd go, boy, this is Jimi Hendrix, and this is guitar, and da-da-da-da, and he would tell me those things, and kind of expanded my musical genre. And before he passed, every year, I would send him songs, and he would send me songs in different genres to say, oh, I kind of like that. My dad was a music snob. He played the accordion, the guitar, so he kind of liked to listen to different kind of music, and I would introduce him to, you know, being, this was the 80s and the 90s, and, you know, well, shoot, 70s and 80s, when Devo and stuff I'd listen to in college, but I knew that my dad would like, I would give it to him, and he'd come back to me with some old school stuff, so that kind of continued for a long, long time until he passed.
I hope the music continues. The day's coming when it's going to be harder for these folks to keep the structure the way it is and still have you wearing that star on your T-shirt. So I hope they figure that out, because it's been pretty good for Cowboy fans as well as the McClay family for you to be here. Will McClay, thanks for your time.
Appreciate it. Thanks.
Will McClay on Then and Now. I'm Brad Sham.
Then and Now with Brad Sham is a production of Vocal. For more information and more programming, please visit vocalnow.com. That's VOKALnow.com.